From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. That's the sound of a Broadway star warming up.
We are in my dressing room at the Stephen Sondheim Theater on West 43rd Street, right near Times Square.
But is that all it takes to do this?
These are high-level vocal athletes that go on a stage relatively cold.
A look at vocal cords and how to keep them healthy.
They're nice and shiny, kind of pearly white. They're pliable and loose and floppy.
Also on the show, we explore Camden as a hub for innovations.
You can go all over the world and talk about things, and when you say, you know, that was invented in Camden, New Jersey, people can't believe it. They absolutely cannot believe it.
First, the news.
Me, 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 me.
What you're hearing is part of the soundtrack of Camden's history.
This is like a time machine.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
I'm Tanya English.
I'm Alana Gordon.
I'm Zach Seward.
I'm Elizabeth Perez Luna.
I'm Jeanette Woods.
And I'm Mike and Scott. The Pulse doesn't mind waiting in the ER or diving into a beehive to understand the latest research and treatments.
Injuries to the brain due to experience.
The same neutral, blank, indescribable nothing.
There are things that you do that influence your friends, friends, friends.
Finally, it feels like I'm in med school, you know?
Robots are really just computers with motors.
I had to actually learn to think like a sighted person.
The relationship, how doesn't have selection, right. And how
you feel a lot of happiness.
I'm just giving you some of the medicine for your IV.
What happened to you?
On today's show, how singers keep their voices healthy, how men learn about fatherhood, and how medical guidelines can become entertaining. But first, back to that scratchy record and the history of Camden. The Victrola was made here by RCA during a time when Camden was a tech hub, the Silicon Valley of its era. Zach Seward takes a look at Camden's past and investigates whether a new generation of inventions, this time with a medical focus, can bring the struggling city back from the brink.
See, this is the neat thing.
Joe Pane and Jim Hemscott are company men. 61 years of service between them to good old RCA, which put Camden, New Jersey on the map with a heap of national firsts.
Oh, wow. So that's the first radio show was broadcast out of Camden, right? In 1920?
Yeah.
They did microphones, radar, the first TV set, which debuted in 1939.
No, that's here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sonar was developed here. Sonar was developed here?
Yep.
Really?
Yep.
Wow.
The three of us are looking at a timeline stretched 15 feet or so across a wall of the RCA Heritage Program Museum. Pane and Hemscott run the place. It's a room and a half housed in Rowan University's main library, and it's packed with mementos of RCA's technological preeminence.
All right, we're all wound up.
Hemscott fires up an iconic RCA relic built in Camden by the Victor Talking Machine Company before RCA was even RCA.
This Victrola with the Caruso record is essentially a 105, 106-year time machine.
This is a tremendous contribution, and RCA kept this in Camden.
RCA basically created the middle class in South Jersey.
It all started in 1901 with that famous dog, Nipper, staring into a phonograph. RCA came along in 1919 at the behest of the U.S. government. America needed the radio technology its European counterparts had flaunted during World War I. GE created RCA, and the military gave the new company rights to the nation's radio waves. By 1937, RCA was Camden's top employer, with 13,000 workers, about a tenth of the city's entire population at the time.
So you're saying it was that sort of Silicon Valley kind of culture of its era.
Yes. And it brought in the secretaries, and it brought in the cabinet makers and the machinists and the factory workers. And people would come in to New Jersey because there were so many jobs there.
Hemscott says things really picked up after World War II, with RCA becoming a leading commercial partner of a then-nascent security state. You probably know RCA as an entertainment company, but plenty of kibble was flowing into Nipper's Bowl by way of contracts from the Department of Defense and NASA.
The International Space Station. We still do the communications and tracking system. All of the video and all of the audio and all of the tracking that you see from the International Space Station came from Camden.
But as RCA's fortunes rose, things for its home city began to crumble. The good times peaked in the mid-50s, then the familiar tale of white flight and political corruption set in. The 70s were really bad, and in the 80s, crack hit. RCA was bought by GE in 1986 and basically sold for parts.
It's worth noticing that the timeline ends with the 20th century. Is there a reason for that?
Well... yeah, there's a reason. We kind of lost interest in what's happening after that.
Hemscott quickly points out that some of the engineering spirit of RCA still remains in Camden, though many of its innovations and firsts live on under a different name.
We are in the L3 Communications Systems East Operations Facility. This is where everything we design gets manufactured.
Dave Micah is the president of this division of L3. It's located right under the old RCA Tower in downtown Camden, which was converted into lofts about a decade ago. This is a modern-day factory floor. No Victrolas here.
This is state-of-the-art manufacturing. Absolutely.
Over 700 people work at L3 in Camden. They're hiring, actually. And about half are engineers. L3 is basically continuing the work of the top secret wing of the defunct RCA. Its bread and butter is secure communications.
About 75% of the work we do is very classified, so we can't get into a lot of details of that. But suffice it to say that the things we do here are to provide equipment for the men and women in the armed service who are protecting this country.
Micah says 100% of his division's work is for the Department of Defense, foreign armies, or the intelligence agencies. The day before we met, he was meeting with the NSA, which has worked with RCA since 1960. The stuff L3 can talk about is secure phone terminals used by nearly all DC officials to talk classified information, battlefield sensors used in Iraq and Afghanistan that are buried underground to detect approaching enemies, and the communication systems used on warships.
The stuff we do is many years ahead of what you would find in many cases in commercial industry.
Micah admits his company is not all that well known outside of the military contractor community. A lot of the work can't be advertised. But the hope is that keeping an engineering spirit alive in the poorest city in the nation will help lead to better days.
I'd like to make it the next Silicon Valley. That's a stretch goal.
A little bit.
Yeah, right.
Micah's a company man, too. He started work at RCA in 1984 and climbed the ranks to the top of L3. He's seen things change in Camden, now a city of just 77,000. But Micah and others I spoke with say they're more optimistic than they've ever been about a Camden turnaround, largely because of another high-tech force building up strength.
So we have an emerging scientific community here in Camden. It's really exciting to watch.
That's Steve Treziak of Cooper University Healthcare, and you guessed it, that growing source of momentum is the medical field.
So I think that our emerging scientific community represents opportunity. So over the next 5 years, 10 years, I think others will see that opportunity and gravitate here to test new innovations.
So that's the hope here, is that startups and other private investments sprouts up around these big institutional pillars.
Zach, that sounds like a lot of optimism. What are some actual examples?
Probably the biggest deal is this new partnership between Cooper and MD Anderson out of the University of Texas. MD Anderson has held the top ranking in the country for cancer care for several years now, and getting them to open up an East Coast base of operations here in Camden was a major victory. It's worth mentioning that the chairman of the Cooper board is the South Jersey political boss, George Norcross, so that type of influence has also helped speed development. The new Cooper/MD Anderson Cancer Center, it opened just a few months ago, and it accounts for a big chunk of that $455 million in construction activity in Camden over the last 3 years.
Wow, that's a lot of money. Who is driving that?
Yeah, it's almost entirely big nonprofit institutions, Classic, Eds, and Meds. So I stopped by the main redevelopment outfit in Camden and got some new numbers that are going to come out in an upcoming report of theirs. And 42% of the jobs in downtown Camden are in healthcare. So that's how big of a player it's becoming.
So I'm wondering, is all of this going to help the city of Camden and the people who live in Camden?
Fair question. There is a lot of positive momentum, and you talk to these people and you can kind of believe in the vision. There's this reorganized police force that's seeing some success in tackling Camden's staggering amount of crime. And those institutional pillars from Rutgers Camden to Rowan, which is now a research university, and that's actually a big deal. They're putting down these major stakes, but those green shoots of private development aren't really there yet. And it's also easy for some of that optimism about Camden's future to be washed away when you take a drive through the neighborhoods. They're pretty bleak. So it does seem like things might be heading in the right direction. It's just going to take time.
Thank you, Zach.
You're welcome, Mike.
And Zach, there is a reason we're playing this Springsteen song right now, and you posted the answer on our website.
There is. Check it out.
WHYY.org/ThePulse. The story originally aired on The Pulse in January. Temple University researchers are in the Gulf of Mexico right now studying the effects of ocean acidification on the deep sea. They describe ocean acidification as a byproduct of rising CO2 levels that could impact plant and animal life in the Earth's oceans. We met marine biologist Eric Cordes on a recent edition of The Pulse, and he told us about his trips to the bottom of the ocean in the submersible Alvin. So we checked in with him this week while he was in the Alvin, on the bottom of the ocean, about a mile down. We connected via the commando bridge on their research ship, and the sound is a little bit muffled, and we also had to say over after each question and answer. So take a listen. Eric, tell me how you're doing and where you are and what you're seeing. Over.
Hi, Mike. We are down at about a little over 500 meters on the seafloor in the Gulf of Mexico. We are looking at some deep sea corals right outside our porthole here. So we're sitting in front of what I would describe as a coral garden. There are some big sea pans sticking up 2 to 3 meters in height all around us. We see some crabs crawling around looking for little bits of food. And there are some hard corals, Lophelia, the species that we've been working on, right in front of us, forming a little reef structure that's supporting all of the habitat and these other species. Over.
What has been the best thing you've seen so far on this trip? Over.
We've revisited a few sites that I know very well, and it's great to see that the reefs are doing well. On my first dive, I saw the largest shark that I've ever seen in the deep sea. Over.
How big was it? Over.
Well, we just got a glimpse. I would say he was probably 7 or 8 feet long, and right when he got close and we got a good view of him, he turned away and saw his tail swish and he took off into the blackness. We tried to follow him, but he was much too fast for us. Over.
Have you learned anything in terms of ocean acidification, or is it too soon yet with this trip? Over.
So far we found that the pH is low, is very low for coral reefs to be surviving, but it looks very similar to how it's been in years past, and we're not sure if there has been a decrease from what we measured in years before. Over.
Thank you so much, Eric, and we wish you the best for the rest of your mission, and we look forward to talking with you when you come back. Over.
Thanks, Mike. It was great to talk to you. I'll talk to you soon. Over.
Eric Cordes is a Temple University marine biologist, and we connected with him as he was floating around the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico in the submersible Alvin. The work Eric Cordes is doing feeds into a quickly expanding body of science on the effects of climate change, and a major study out this week presents more evidence on this issue. The U.S. government report found that warming has caused more frequent or intense heat waves and downpours in some regions, and more floods and droughts in others. The study called National Climate Assessment found the impacts of climate change being felt in every corner of the United States. A key difference between this report and others? Scientists are more confident that human activity has driven most of the warming in the past 50 years. Coming up on The Pulse, training Broadway stars to take care of their voices.
So you do things like that are called in Nerdville semi-occluded vocal tract postures. So one of the most popular is the lip trill. So you kind of get the instrument going, you get the muscles coordinated, and then you're ready to go.
That's next on The Pulse.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca's patient assistance programs help qualified patients access the AstraZeneca medicines they need while providing them with information that can help them stay healthy. In 2013, AstraZeneca served more than 567,000 patients through its prescription savings programs, including AZ and Me and the MedImmune Assistance Program. Learn more at azandme.com and myaccess360.com.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents can help explain the changes and prepare you for what's ahead. More at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. Broadway singers usually perform 8 shows a week, with just Mondays off. So for stars in the show, that can mean belting for several hours almost every day. Given that demanding schedule, you might think Broadway performers take extra care to keep their voices healthy. But a new survey suggests that's not the case. Christopher Intagliata reports.
I'm sitting backstage with the Broadway singer Jared Spector.
We are in my dressing room at the Stephen Sondheim Theater on West 43rd Street, right near Times Square.
He just got a Tony nomination for his role as Barry Mann in Beautiful, the Carole King musical. And right now he's running through a few warm-up exercises, a half-hour routine he does before most shows.
As long as I'm good and warmed up, I can sing anything in my range, including falsetto.
Which he sang a lot of in his 6 years playing Frankie Valli in Jersey Boys.
It's a relentless, never-ending task to take care of your body so that you can hit those notes day after day after day. Because if you do anything the night before, going out and drinking, screaming, if you get sick, anything that takes away, say, the top 10% of your range, well, you're out. That's it. You can't sing it. You have to be in the utmost health at all times to be able to sing a role of, you know, that difficulty. After a while, you know, you learn what your personal limits are. I would struggle with something like acid reflux, so I had to make sure I didn't eat too close to bed. But having a glass of wine at night, a couple nights a week, certainly not a problem.
And regular checkups at the doctor are a must.
I'd rather go and then tell me I'm fine. And when they tell me you're not fine, you have to take a couple of days off of singing. Then I do.
But Jared's routine isn't necessarily the norm among Broadway singers.
Only about half of them warm up. I mean, again, these are high-level vocal athletes that go on a stage relatively cold.
That's Ryan Bransky, Associate Director of New York University's Voice Center, a place where some Broadway singers go when they hurt their voices.
We just looked at 25 vocal folds this morning.
Vocal folds is the anatomical term for vocal cords.
We can place a small camera through your nose or through your mouth to take a good look at your vocal cords. In health, they're nice and shiny, kind of pearly white. They're pliable and loose and floppy. But then when the system breaks down, you get, you know, bleeding or bumps or lumps or just kind of a whole gamut of things that can happen.
Drew Gehling plays Bob Gaudio in Jersey Boys.
Well, you knew it from the start. Someday you'll break my heart. Now we're all through.
He ended up at the Voice Center when part of his singing range disappeared.
I had a vocal injury a few years ago that I thought was going to essentially end my career.
He was diagnosed with a mild stiffening of one of his vocal folds. During that downtime, Drew surveyed 135 of his fellow performers, both lead and ensemble, about their habits off stage. He asked
a slew of questions regarding their warm-up habits, their cool-down habits, their alcohol intake, their sleep, caffeine intake, the difficulty of their shows and jobs.
He and Ryan recently published the survey in the Journal of Voice, and the results weren't quite what they expected. Here's Ryan again.
You would anticipate that the vast majority of them live a rather kind of boring life outside of the theater, and that's not at all the case. Alcohol consumption across all of the performers was greater than 90%.
A quarter of the performers Drew surveyed reported using illicit drugs, and a tenth said they regularly smoke cigarettes.
This really is a truly gifted group of performers that can get away with a lot and maintain an incredibly high level of vocal health.
Meaning they injure their voices a lot less than other high-risk professions, like teachers and telemarketers.
Teachers have a drastically higher rate of vocal injury when compared to these guys that are doing 8 shows a week.
So what's the secret?
That is a great question that I'm not sure that we have an answer to right now. I mean, you know, biologically, if you were to, you know, cut off my head and cut off Drew's head, we'd probably sound exactly the same. I mean, the source, our larynxes are probably engineered relatively similarly. But he can do things with his voice that, frankly, I can't.
The rest of our lives, we can't.
They really are mutants. I mean, they are high-level athletes.
And Drew is now a pre-med student, in addition to his full-time career on Broadway.
It's a scary thing to go through, to suddenly be faced with not being able to do what you do anymore. And I feel like medicine is about helping people and making people better. And that's what I want to do.
When singers like Drew do end up at the Voice Center, the operating room isn't the first stop.
You know, we have folks that come in that are doing 8 shows a week that are really struggling. And we see that there are architectural changes to the vocal folds. And so we're on the fence. You know, is this something that we need to consider taking a day off or pulling out or considering surgery? And a lot of times we can send them to Brian.
I'm Brian Gill. I'm director of vocal pedagogy and music and performing arts professions in the Steinhardt School at New York University.
Brian helps singers work through minor injuries by teaching them to sing more safely. And it starts with a little physics.
So the vocal folds are down in the larynx, in the neck. So the airflow coming up from the lungs makes them vibrate. But if there's too much resistance there, the tissue will have increased friction, and friction's the enemy of that tissue.
Think of how friction causes calluses on your hands or feet. The same can happen to your vocal folds. You want to minimize that friction.
So you do things like that are called in Nerdville semi-occluded vocal tract postures. So one of the most popular is the lip trill. And when you go, and you have this buzz going at your lips, you've actually created a resistance at your lips, which reduces the amount of pressure that falls across the vocal folds. So you kind of get the instrument going, you get the muscles coordinated, you become more aware of the resonance, and you become more aware of the breath energy. If they're pressing on their voice, that'd be bad. And then they get used to the flowy feeling that more efficient, and then they try and reproduce that in the show.
But aside from that flowy feeling, there's another trick performers can use to belt louder without hurting themselves, singing the right vowel sounds in songs.
The vocal tract, the way it's shaped, has a certain pitch or pitches at which it resonates best. I'll give you an example of E-A-I-O-U.
He's flicking his throat as he mouths those vowel sounds.
When I shape those vowels, there's a particular pitch in there, and those pitches line up with the information that's coming from the vocal folds themselves. And when they interact positively, you can get a really good boost of sound. You can also get like a really belty sound if you hit the right resonance of the vocal tract with the right harmonic from the vocal folds. But in actuality, you're not working that hard.
Frankie Valli used that trick to his advantage, as did Jared Spector, the guy who was warming up at the beginning of the piece when he played Valli in Jersey Boys.
There's a song, Working My Way Back to You, in Jersey Boys. And if you try to sing, Working My Way Back to You, first of all, it doesn't sound right. It's completely out of the style. But, you know, also how did Frankie sing it? And he doesn't say way, he says weh. So it's, Working My Way Back to You, babe.
Working my way back to you, babe.
And you hear the word way because you know what it is, but it's so much easier to sing, and so much easier to sing that high note.
Brian Gill, the voice coach, says you can also hear that vowel change in the tune Astonishing from Little Women.
At the end, the character sings Astonishing, but they actually never sing Astonishing, because if they did, it would tune in a way that would sound too disconnected. So they all sing Astonishing.
Astonishing.
And it's wide open, so they can get a belty sound. If you live in a society where in music theater everybody's supposed to be able to do legit and belt and all these things and sort of gospely screams, and then finding what you can do sustainably is the key to a really long career.
As is taking good care of your instrument, the voice. Here's Jared again.
I find that a lot of my castmates are always like, wow, you're so diligent with your voice. It's like, yeah, because I want to sing tomorrow. You know, when I go out on stage, I don't hold back. I sing full out every single night.
Girl, there's a better.
For The Pulse, I'm Christopher Intagliata.
Time now for a science news update. Joining us is regular Pulse contributor Cary Grenz. Cary is an associate editor with The Scientist, and in that role, she reviews a lot of scientific studies every week, and she keeps us posted on the latest. This week, her picks are young blood, female bats, and penguin flu. Hi, Cary.
Hi, Maiken.
Cary, let's start with this research on young blood. I've seen a lot about this on social media, but what is really happening with this research?
Well, I will tell you, don't go around drinking mouse blood. Whatever you've seen on social media, it might not be true. There's room for caution here. But there has been this idea for many years now that elements in the blood of young animals can rejuvenate older animals. And researchers have been looking for the secret sauce in the young blood to see if those components could be harnessed to treat injuries or age-related degeneration. And three studies came out this week that tested various parts of the blood from young mice. In one case, the plasma from young mice was given to older mice, and it helped them perform better on memory tests in the laboratory. In a second case, injecting just a single protein called GDF11 caused the old mice to sprout new brain cells and blood vessels in the brain. This protein is more abundant in the blood of younger mice and then declines with age. And then in a third study, researchers showed that GDF11 could also build muscle tissue and actually improve the strength and endurance of older mice. So together, these reports start to home in on the rejuvenating components of blood.
What does all of this mean for humans? Is this a step closer to the fountain of youth that we are always looking for?
We hope, maybe. But none of these experiments were done in humans, so it remains to be seen whether these ingredients like GDF11 or plasma or whatnot could actually slow or even reverse aging in people. And of course, there's always the concern when you're giving somebody an agent that causes growth in one way or another, whether it's a blood vessel or a brain cell, that it could develop into a cancer. So we are a long way away from finding the actual fountain of youth.
Cary, let's move on to some new findings on the so-called white nose syndromes and bats. What did researchers find out with that?
So white nose syndrome has been a very big problem for little brown bats and other bat species, especially in Pennsylvania, but also many other states in the U.S. It's a fungal disease. And in the past 5 years or so, it has spread rapidly throughout eastern and central Pennsylvania. But for some reason, there was this little corner of western Pennsylvania that was a holdout against the disease for a couple of years. Researchers want to know why that is and how this fungus gets around. So they compared bat genes from uninfected and infected colonies of bats. And they found that bats from infected areas in eastern and central Pennsylvania had a certain set of genetic markers, while bats from the uninfected holdouts of western Pennsylvania had a different cluster of genetic markers. These genes were only genes that are inherited from female bats. Genes that also come from males weren't so tightly contained to these distinct regions of the state. So the researchers conclude that it's the migrations of female bats that are linked with the spread of white nose syndrome.
So will that help them contain the disease, perhaps?
Hopefully. At least it might help them predict where the disease might spread next, and then from there, perhaps stop its progression.
Finally, let's talk about penguin flu. Do penguins get the flu, or do they have their own flu?
They get an influenza virus, but they don't get the flu in the sense that, you know, they're sick, at least. This new type of avian influenza virus that has been detected in penguins in Antarctica doesn't seem to make them sick. But it's an unusual flu virus. It's not totally surprising that it was detected in Antarctica. There had been signs that the virus was there. Blood samples from penguins had indicated that there were immune responses to the flu, but they hadn't actually pinned down the virus. So scientists took a throat swab and a cloaca swab, that's kind of the all-in-one hole of birds, and they found the virus, and then they did some genetic analysis, and they saw that the virus is totally unique. Its closest related strains of flu emerged decades ago. So they don't know how it got to Antarctica, how long it's been there, and what precisely it's doing to the birds, because as I said, none of them really seemed sick.
But is this one of those strange viruses that could then affect humans?
Well, definitely not yet. They did expose ferrets to the virus, and the ferrets didn't catch it. So, you know, I don't think it's going to turn into any kind of global pandemic just yet. But of course, as we know, the flu can mutate very quickly and change. I think the concern is more for wildlife at this point than for humans.
Thank you so much, Carrie.
Thank you, Maiken.
Carrie Grenz is an associate editor with The Scientist and a regular contributor to The Pulse. Coming up on The Pulse, teaching men to be better fathers.
In our class, discipline means that you're supposed to teach a lesson, an unpainful lesson.
Does dad training work? That's next on The Pulse.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence Blue Cross is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents will be available to help clear up confusion, answer questions, and even help you decide on a policy. IBC is dedicated to helping you make the best decision with your health insurance. The Independence Express truck is visiting neighborhoods now. More information online at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca is dedicated to improving health in communities across the Philadelphia region. On Twitter at AstraZenecaUS or on Facebook at AstraZenecaUS Community Connections.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. There's little debate that a dad's consistent presence makes children's lives better. It's less clear if you can actually teach fathers how to be good fathers. And even though there isn't much research on outcomes, many people are big supporters of responsible fatherhood programs. To see how they work, Tanya English stopped by the West Philadelphia YMCA.
By 6 p.m., the Tuesday night pickup game is running full court. But a few men walk past the gym and gather instead in a quiet classroom in the back. That's where dads get together for a weekly Father's Club meeting.
Well, you've been at NIC, you guys have some time.
Yeah, I had to take some time off.
The discussion starts with a disagreement over Nick Foles and Michael Vick. But there's also some debate over the staying power of braids or barrettes. These are the kind of dads that know what it takes to keep a third grader's unruly hair in check. About 6 to 10 fathers stop by each week to talk and to work on their parenting skills. Joel Austin organizes the meeting.
Anybody want to check in real quick? A quick check-in?
Gerald Giles is the first to share.
Well, my youngest son is in Texas with his mom and kind of missing him.
Then another dad talks about his 12-year-old.
Still going through the, you know, the tween situation with the girls, trying to stay one step ahead. If I can, you know, yeah.
Austin leads this support group in his free time, but his company, Daddy University, gets paid to train social workers to include fathers in whatever nonprofit work they're trying to do. Whether it's preventing teen pregnancy or teaching kids to read, Austin says often social service agencies or the courts don't step in to train dads until after a family needs fixing.
We don't do prevention very well. A lot of people get paid for uninvolved fathers. The prison system, the juvenile system, WIC is because you're not around. Welfare is because you're not around. Like, everybody gets a lot of money when you step off from your kid.
The fathers learn about child development, how to negotiate with a toddler, and they commiserate over the clashes that happen when they try to co-parent. Last week, the lesson was about setting rules and consequences. And this week, 33-year-old Ted Smith reports back to the class.
I told my daughter, her name is Charlie. I said, Charlie, if you don't eat all your food, then you will not have dessert. Because she likes strawberry milk and ice cream. And she said, okay. And she ate all her food. And then the next day, she didn't eat all her food. I said, Charlie, if you don't eat all your food, then she's like, I know, I don't get any pink milk. And she didn't eat it. She didn't get no pink milk. And we were both happy.
These dads say that their group is a success. But researcher Jay Fagan says most fatherhood programs haven't measured their influence on kids' well-being or health.
There's very little evidence saying that it works. Folks really don't know what impact they have on fathers and families.
The federal government spends tens of millions of dollars each year to get fathers more involved in their children's lives. Fagan and his team at Temple University are studying whether that investment is paying off.
The question of what does it mean to be a responsible fatherhood, there's not a real clear definition of what we mean by that.
Meanwhile, back at the YMCA, Joel Austin keeps on teaching what he thinks works to make fathers better dads. Lately, he and the group have been talking about discipline.
Well, if you want to raise someone who's strong-minded and speaks their mind, you can't smack them upside the head every time they ask you a question or every time they open their mouth. If you want someone loving, more men are going to have to say things like, thank you, you're welcome, I love you, I miss you, and I'm there.
Physical punishment is not part of the program's curriculum. But several of the dads have questions. They say their parents kept them in line just fine, with a tap on the butt or a belt. Austin responds with a story from when his son was young.
I busted into his room because of something that he had done, and I had started to spank him. And once I looked at him for a second, and I found out that he wasn't getting me. He was afraid of me.
His strategy has changed.
I use other tools. I'll take a cell phone in a minute.
For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
Laura Benchoff contributed to this report. Medical guidelines and research can be dry. PowerPoint presentations are a known snooze fest. So it's difficult for working physicians to keep up with what's new. Two Jefferson University hospital doctors are offering their fellow physicians a different way to learn.
The consult guys.
The consult guys are Gino Murley and Howard Weitz. They've been friends and colleagues for over three decades. A few years ago, the American College of Physicians asked the two doctors to, quote, do something fun at their national meeting. So they did, and their idea was inspired by public radio.
Gino and I love car talk, and I've learned more from the Tabbitt brothers than I can from most of the professors I've had in college and medical school. I shouldn't say that, but it's true. It's true. So Gino and I plagiarized at its finest, and we put together a one-hour session, a mixture of the Tabbitt brothers, Prairie Home Companion, and we mixed in the Kennedy-Nixon debates and put together a fantasy one-hour radio show that we performed first at the National Meeting of the American College of Physicians. We had made-up call-ins, made-up questions, but questions relating to physicians and the care of their patients. And it was a riot.
I look at it like Howard does. We've walked away from the traditional approach to education. We're communicating with our learners in a comfortable, funny environment, but every single show has a key point or points that you actually learn. It's like we make learning sticky, a concept, we make it sticky so it stays in your head.
Merle and Weitz did their show as a live event for several years, and now they tape online video segments distributed by the College of Physicians. Viewers can get credit for continuing medical education. Each segment answers one question, and I asked them where they get their questions from. Here's Howard Weitz.
We research the medical literature, and we look for areas of controversy and areas of practice change. We're very concerned that there are physicians practicing who may not be aware of the changes in style, practice, or clinical research data. And we build the questions around that. Now, on the show, we've invited the listening audience and the viewing audience to send us questions about their cases.
The number of things that people ask, and they're very focused questions. People are always interested when you have an MRI. And say you have a prosthetic heart valve. Is it safe to do an MRI? So Howard did this whole presentation on safety in using MRIs for pacemakers, for valves of the heart that were mechanical. But that was an example of very focused learning, and people remember it. I can do an MRI on a patient with a special kind of pacemaker or heart valve.
Do you stay within your field of expertise, or do you take on questions that are outside of that field and then research them?
No, we take all questions, diabetes, green urine secondary to anesthesia.
We are so out of our area of training expertise. One of our most popular shows is it safe to wear a necktie in the patient care environment? There's a controversy that neckties can be harbors of bacteria. And in fact, the National Health Service in Great Britain banned neckties in the patient care environment. So Gino and I researched the world's literature, found it skimpy at best to ban neckties. And we challenged the entire British health system in a 7-minute show. So, and that's so out of my area of cardiology, you can't even imagine.
Do you ever get people saying to you, well, who are you to tell?
All the time, man.
Whenever you do something like this, you always venture out to, and there are our constituents out there saying, well, who gave these guys the license to be able to do this? And the answer is we decided we were going to do this.
And I actually hope that we inspire others to do it too, because, you know, the old days of sitting in a lecture for an hour or hour and a half, they are long gone. It is too painful to keep up to date that way. And I feel that the focused, brief clinical teaching interaction is the way to go.
And do you two agree on your answers?
Always. We always agree. We agree on everything. No, we actually, at times, we disagree.
Right.
We disagree. But we want to make sure at the conclusion of the show, there's a clear-cut answer.
Yes.
Whether it be yes, no, this choice, that choice, or we're not sure because no one's sure.
Now, you mentioned earlier the case of the green urine. I do think that warrants some explanation. So what was that all about?
The case was a patient who was undergoing back surgery. And into the surgery, their urine turned Kelly green. Yeah, and the question is to the audience, what do you do? Do you stop the surgery? Do you get certain blood tests? Do you give certain medicines? Or do you keep on operating? And Gino and I used it as an opportunity to talk about urine color changes during or after surgery, and color changes occur. A very rare but real interaction caused by propofol anesthesia. Propofol is one of the most common anesthetic agents. In a small number of patients, it will turn the urine Kelly green. And there's no bad side effect to this. You just keep on operating.
How do you find time for this?
Well, that's what nights and weekends are for,
right? Exactly right.
Nights and weekends, you know, Gino is my closest friend. And I think he'd say the same about me. Right, Gino?
Absolutely.
Okay. So Gino and I talk 7 days a week. We are always on in terms of consult, guys. And we collect this info all the time.
Howard Weitz and Gino Merle are Jefferson physicians, and they are better known as the consult guys. Are you tracking your steps, counting your calories? Are you all about the quantified self? Here's another constellation in the me universe that deserves our attention, sleep. What's the right amount where we feel rested, good, and our brains function at their best? The current recommendation from the National Sleep Foundation is 7 to 9 hours a night for adults. But a group of researchers is going to reevaluate that because those guidelines were issued more than a decade ago.
In the last 10 years, there's been a lot of work on how sleep fits alongside other aspects of health like diet, exercise.
Penn sleep researcher Michael Grandner will be part of the team reviewing new studies and findings and making sure those numbers are still accurate. Grandner says as researchers learn more about the impact of sleep on mood, cognitive functioning, and overall health, it could become a new American obsession, up there with Zumba or South Beach.
It may be easier to change than diet, but it may have somewhere in that realm of importance.
Grandner says within that 7 to 9 hour range, optimal sleep depends on the individual. So if you're not sure whether you're getting enough sleep, do some scientific experimentation.
Maybe you might want to try increasing your sleep time by about 10, 15 minutes for a week or two. See how that goes.
That sounds interesting. Do you want to track your sleep and your overall well-being for a week or so and report back to us? Email us at thepulse@whyy.org.
I'm so sleepy, yeah. I'm so sleepy, yeah. I could lay my head on a piece of...
Last week, we heard a commentary from CHOP infectious diseases doctor Kristen Feemster. She made a passionate plea for ending vaccine exemptions for parents who believe vaccines are bad for their children. Feemster argued that these exemptions endanger the health and well-being of all children and adults. We asked for your responses, and we got them. Here are a few examples. Oleg commented on our website. He said, "By doing away with exemptions, you no longer allow a parent to think how to best raise their own children. You ask them to forget about their faith or to abide by it. And what about all the vaccine-damaged children out there? Who will be raising them?" Dorit replied to this comment, "There is a difference between requiring something that protects children and the community and taking over 24/7 parenting." We also got an email from Jesse who said that it's not necessarily an all-or-nothing proposition. There are people out there who are vaccinating on an alternative or delayed schedule. She further said, "One point my doctor brought up to me is that he thought we often vaccinate too early when the immune system is not ready for it." We do appreciate your comments and feedback, so please keep them coming at thepulse@whyy.org. Resident physicians famously work really long hours, but some still find time to engage in issues that are important to them outside of work. Dr. Kanani Tichin was just recognized for such extracurricular activities with the $25,000 Medilita Hero Award. Medilita makes scrubs, and the award is meant as a way to recognize residents who inspire their peers. Tichin is a pediatrics resident at Jefferson Hospital, and she won the award for her research on child sex trafficking. She sat down with us to tell us about that project.
Over the past year, I've been doing a research project to gauge the knowledge and attitudes of physicians toward child sex trafficking patients. One of the things that I found is that most physicians don't know that child sex trafficking is an issue here in the United States. It's a domestic issue. It affects American citizens. And they don't realize that they're seeing these patients in their clinics, in their emergency departments, because they're not looking for them. They're not looking for the warning signs. So one of the things that I'm hoping to achieve is to educate physicians about the warning signs of child sex trafficking and to give them the tools to be able to help those patients.
Because I guess being at a doctor's office offers a perhaps one-time opportunity to intervene?
Yeah, that's right. So a lot of these kids, they do not come in for regular care. They come in for care only when they need it, STDs, traumatic injuries. So when they do present, it provides sort of a critical opportunity for a physician, whether an emergency medicine physician or an adolescent med physician, to interview that patient, enter their life for a brief moment, gather some information, and provide a relationship that could potentially help them either in that moment, but more likely down the line.
And what are some warning signs that physicians should look for?
Some of them include just what population is at risk. So foster care children are particularly at risk, children that come from lower socioeconomic classes, although sex trafficking can affect all classes, all races, all ethnicities. Tattoos. Some tattoos can be telling. Obviously, a lot of people get tattoos. It's not associated with child sex trafficking, but a number of pimps will brand their girls so that it's sort of a way of claiming ownership over their bodies. A lot of these kids come into adult emergency departments claiming to be over 18, over 21 of age, presenting with repeated STDs, presenting with traumatic injuries, particularly to the head where it's less visible, presenting with repeated pregnancies. Those are some of the typical signs.
How do you find time to do extra work outside of your residency to focus on human trafficking?
In some, I don't know. I've always been a person that's been active in volunteerism, in the arts. I started pursuing my passion in child sex trafficking. I had been doing reading for a number of years and really was lucky to pair up with Dr. Eliza Chin with the American Medical Women's Association, as well as Dr. Iman Sharif at Nemours DuPont. And both of them have been incredible mentors to me in helping me to accomplish this project. I could not have done this alone. So finding the time became easy once I realized that this made me a happier person and that I needed this in my life in order to be a better resident and a better physician.
Kanani Tichin is a resident in pediatrics at Jefferson Hospital and Nemours AI DuPont Hospital for Children. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Zach Seward, and Alana Gordon. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Joel Patterson, our associate producer. Megan Pinto is our executive producer. Chris Atulo is vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey, chief content officer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, you can subscribe to our podcast at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And we'd really like to hear from you. Email us with your feedback at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening. It's all you know.